Hello.
Hello, welcome to Discursion, the podcast where we discuss recently released or reissued DVDs and Blu-rays.
With your usual host, Dominic.
And Stephen.
This time, we're going to be talking about the recent Criterion release of Olivier Assayas's 1994 film Cold Water.
I think that plot summary for this one, the customary plot summary, is going to be a bit easier than usual because it's quite a short film, isn't it? It's not a short, but it's a short feature.
It's got the kind of classic sort of film length, hasn't it? That, you know, hour and a half.
Yeah.
Which I think is quite a good length for a film, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to have an attempt at giving an outline of what it's all about?
Well, Olivier Assayas said that the structuring device for this film was music, and that makes sense because the film starts with the two main characters, the two young lovers, stealing a record from a shop, right? And those are the records. Some of those records will be played later in the film at a party. But the stealing of those records will also result in one of the main characters being sent to an institution for insubordinate young high school kids.
Delinquents, yes.
Which she's going to escape. And she manages to outmaneuver her parents and also the officials, I suppose, at this institution, and go to a big house party at a chateau, which takes up a good, half of the film, or the latter third of the film.
It sort of almost feels like it's the set piece around which the film organises itself, you know, although you don't realise that it's impending. I don't think you feel a big set piece coming, but sort of perhaps, yeah, some way into it you realise that this is in some way the sort of centre of the film, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm not quite clear to what extent it's autobiographical, you know, specific terms, but it's definitely set exactly at the time when... So it's set in the early 70s?
Yeah.
I mean, the protagonist is 16, and so whenever Assayas was born, I think that's kind of exactly right. So there's a sense in which it definitely represents his teenage years. And that sense of sort of memories of teenage parties, I can very much empathise with as well. It seems to reflect... Although it seems more... My sense of that big scene is it's more about the experience of those teenage parties. You know, I'm not exactly sure if I could say how it would have been filmed differently, but I can imagine the film being made in which that sequence was somehow about one sense of remembering being a teenager. But I feel like it's more directed at what it feels like when you are a teenager.
Yeah, there's a great distance that stops the film from slipping into nostalgia or sentimentalism. Mm.
As you said, you know, it's about a kind of a pair of teenage lovers and their trials and tribulations with authority of various forms, whether parental or school or other institutions. And yes, it has that sense of that kind of teenage friendship and teenage, you know, fighting with your friends, and it's some form of coming of age story. Mainly, I think about Gilles, the male protagonist, and it's shot in a sort of it's shot in a number of ways, but there's particularly the beginning. There's quite a lot of prevalence of kind of handheld, sort of in your face kind of cinematography, which I think we've definitely seen in other kind of coming of age type films. So why is this film not just a collection of cliches?
I suppose one reason is that it's sort of a mixture of those things, but it isn't any of them. Mm. So it seems to stand somewhere between the poles of sort of the 400 Blows and, I don't know, The Breakfast Club or something like that. There's a coming of ageness to it that teenagers could maybe watch and enjoy as a film, but there's also a social realism to it that's dealing with issues of class and a sort of documentary realism to the film, that's trying to capture the 70s as a kind of, as a period, as a as a moment.
I mean, I should make it clear, I asked that question, I mean, I think it's, watching it again, as we just had, I think is the second time I've seen it. I was impressed the first time I saw it. I was all the more impressed. But yeah, there's something slightly odd, because then if you list the ingredients, they kind of look very familiar. I mean, even down to, Gilles is kicked out of a French class by a French literature class by an irate teacher because he has no feeling for literature because he's not paying attention to Rousseau as he should be. But then we find later that he's got, is it Allen Ginsberg? If it's not Allen Ginsberg, it's another of the Beats anyway, in his pocket, and he sort of just reads a couple of lines and then puts the book back in his pocket and then goes off on his bike reciting perfectly a whole chunk of the poem in English. So again, it's like, he's kind of fascinated by literature, just not the literature which is being forced on him by his teachers, and that seems to be that's a familiar trope from the kind of coming of age rebellion film. It's done sort of, with a subtlety and without a nostalgia, or at least it doesn't, not without any nostalgia. There is some sense, particularly of those songs, and I know Assias has said that those were the songs that were important to him at that time, so it's the performances as well, I suppose, the quality of the performances, would you say?
Yes, I mean, there we have mostly non-actors, which gives the film a sort of roughness. Although we should say that I forget the name of the female lead. She had some training.
Yes.
But yeah, I think Assayas wanted it to be as sort of as rough and as ready as possible.
But it has a deceptiveness, doesn't it? Because I think that's one of the interesting things that it does, that it looks, it doesn't, for the most part, kind of draw attention to the way it's constructed. It's not a kind of, it's not the kind of art film that spends its duration wanting you to notice how it's been shot. But it's not nearly as loose as it wants to look like. There are some quite virtuoso bits in the party where it passes off between various characters who are speaking, kind of complex, moving, long takes, which are clearly, very choreographed. But they're also edited as part of longer sequences, so it's not quite the sense of, it'd be a different thing if the entire party was in one long take or something. That would give quite a different texture.
Yeah, I think it was shot over 5 days. And from what Assayas' cinematographer says, he prefers to do long takes to give him some choice in the editing, that precisely, he doesn't have to stage everything and choreograph everything beforehand. Right. He can have a bit of improvisation.
Yeah, but there are certainly, the bit where they're all getting stoned and passing the pipe around, like if you actually stop and think about that, the way that it focuses in on their hands and their faces and this pipe, without anyone else getting in the way sort of ever quite a long period, that's clearly very, meticulously planned.
Yeah, maybe you could distinguish between, I'm just speaking freely, you could distinguish between long takes that are meant to be a bit more showy and the long takes that are there so that improvisation and some sort of realistic performance can take place and allow the individuals to be themselves, although they are supposed to be playing teenagers from the 1970s, even though they're teenagers from, the early 90s?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, for example, there's a long tracking shot of the two lovers sort of leaving the party, and this is just before the key question, which is going to be, do they leave together or not? Do they abandon everything to go and live in the wilderness? There isn't any real sort of plan there. There's a long tracking shot, which is very similar to the tracking shot which ends the 400 Blows, I think. I mean, as people say, Assayas' characters are often running around and moving, and you could say the same thing of Truffaut's films. And those tracking shots really bring that forward. It seemed like homages, those tracking shots, actually. Whereas the other tracking shots, which are not, I don't think, doing that at all.
It's partly also the rhythm, do you think it is? I think it's very well how long things go. Sometimes they go on for longer than you expect, and sometimes they cut when you're not expecting it. But it feels like that keeps it quite not that you're conscious of it being unpredictable, but it just keeps it in motion quite effectively, I find. I mean, it has surprises in it, but there's no sort of thing, there's not much, well, almost nothing, perhaps completely from left field that you'd never thought of, but it's also, so it's not predictable, but it's not wildly unpredictable either. It feels quite right, sort of in retrospect, the way it moves forward, but it's not entirely predictable while it's happening.
Yeah, the Criterion summary on the back of your DVD case describes it as almost experimental, which is probably an important addition to make. It's not experimental. I mean, insofar as this isn't exactly new, is it? Using a super 16mm camera and going around making very long takes and so on and so forth. Although maybe personally a bit of an experiment for Sayas, because before this point he said he had been working with very clunky Panavision cameras and he did this film A New Life, I think it was called, before his fourth film, and which he filmed in widescreen Panavision, and he said that he felt weighed down by it, and so to work with the Super 16 format was to some extent liberating. And
yes,
but I don't think he got carried away.
No, it's just got a kind of lightness, hasn't it? And I feel it's it manages to give the impression of spontaneity while actually being very delicately constructed. I mean, I suppose if this, it's got quite a lot of affection for its characters, hasn't it? The film has, and I think perhaps it doesn't. Yeah. It wouldn't, maybe this is just an obvious thing to say, which is the way that normal films work, but the film doesn't work unless you care about the characters.
Yeah, to what extent is their characterization? I mean, because if I think of those teen movies like The Breakfast Club or maybe something a bit more new wavy like Graffiti or something like that, the characters tend to be types, don't they? Sort of high school types. Mm. I just wondered how far can you take it down that genre route? And so there's the slightly twitchy guy with the dynamite. There's him, and he's quite heavily sort of characterized.
But it does seem
quite memorable. That's his thing. He's the guy with the dynamite. That's his.
I mean, well, at least, but that's as far as we know. But sort of, we're not led to believe that. I can imagine in a different version of this film, like that would be his thing also within the world of the film. You know, he'd be the guy to go to if you want to get dynamite. But in fact, we don't know much about him other than he does get dynamite for Gilles in this particular situation.
Yeah.
He almost sort of resists that type thing, I think. I mean, also there's a thing where there are a bunch of the protagonist's friends at the party who are trying to who are helping to hide Christine from her mother and her mother's boyfriend and things, who are all girls, actually, as it happens. There's kind of the three of them really who are kind of important, but they're not typed in that way, I don't think.
No, not heavily. There's definitely
I mean, they have different personalities, but
yeah,
insofar as we can tell, we don't get to know them very well. But I don't feel it's sort of, it's not like, you know, the bookish one and the sporty one and the slutty one.
No.
Maybe it would be fair to say that if it doesn't, deliberately, it doesn't entirely steer clear of any nostalgia, but it does steer clear of sentimentality. So you don't have what I suspect you might find in your kind of, you know, imaginary average American coming of age, which would be to have the one adult who really gets the kids. And this, you don't have that. The closest you get is actually Christine's mother, who has a quite interesting conversation with Gilles. But even that is quite, it's quite nuanced. It's involving her sort of saying that, kind of recognising that she's not quite cracking it as a mother, but also that she has her own life to leave and to live, and her daughter is annoying.
Each generation has its own rebellion, right?
Yes.
So what, this is like early 70s, and Asayas talks about it being a sort of punk revolt, even though the music he uses isn't categorically sort of rock music, but he's tying it into that 70s revolt, that kind of post, he calls it like post-May 1968 kind of fatigue.
Well, it's pre-punk, isn't it? That's the point. I mean, as in punk as a genre, punk hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
You know, so you have, so you can have, it's quite interesting, you can have things which might, you have a mix of music which would be quite acceptable to at least some of the punks later, kind of Nico, I think probably is, there's something, quite punk about Nico. Roxy Music, for all the artificiality is so obvious and sort of a part of Roxy Music. I think perhaps Roxy Music would kind of, might have got a pass by some. But then you also have Deep Purple, who surely, wouldn't be that long before they would have been turned into perhaps the sort of epitome of the rock kind of dinosaur. But the kids can listen to all this stuff, and it's still, it's their sort of, perhaps it's an unusual time to set a sort of, rock rebellion kind of film, precisely because there's a bunch of things about punk, because that was the story that punk told itself, and then there's a bunch of things about, rock and roll, and then, go back to, or the films that were around at the time of that sort of music, the kinds of, James Dean kind of things. Mm-hmm. Or there's, even the Beatles or something sort of a bit later is something, but this is it's a slightly forgotten.
I'm just wondering, but it's funny to have these 90s kids dancing along to precisely to Roxy Music and Janis Joplin. Maybe I mean, what was around in the 90s, early 90s? Like, this is the film's from 1992, I think. I'm saying,
I thought it was is it 94?
90, oh, possibly 94.
Well, it's Nirvana then. That's.
So
that's
a grungier sort of sound, and I'm wondering if that 70s music by that point would have been seen as being a bit kind of past it.
I think it might also. I think by then it had also come kind of back round, I suppose. And that's another thing I think that perhaps is just worth emphasising, like quite how meticulous that the sound design is. Again, it's quite kind of self-effacing, but it's if the film at times wants to give the impression that it's a little bit like some sort of cinema verite kind of handheld, just catching things on the fly, like the sound is absolutely not that. When Gilles actually gets the dynamite off the dynamite kid, and they're in a kind of staff kind of toilet, and just the sound of the plumbing and thing is very kind of precisely placed. Or later when they're in the country, sound of birds and livestock, which you never see. This is just absolutely straightforward film making, sound design. It's not experimental, but it's, it just struck me quite how carefully it's been done, but in a self-effacing way. It's not, it doesn't want to draw attention to itself. And I think you alluded it to it earlier. I think it's really quite interesting how you, if you do pay attention to it, how the music is used in the party scene. Because strictly speaking, there's no non-diegetic music in the whole film, right? So one way to, kind of two extremes of the ways you could have used the sound in that. In those scenes, one way would be to use the fact that the songs are being played at the party as the excuse for playing those songs, but then not really worry about that in an acoustic or sonic sense. Just have the music, as it would be on the, mixed, like you'd mix kind of soundtrack, music. Or another thing would be to be very to be rather fussy about precisely where you're, you know, where it's coming from, how loud it is, depending on where the characters are and where the actual sound source is. And it seems to me to do something in the middle of those two.
Yeah. It just so happens that the music is often played almost at the perfect moment. The breaking of glass coincides with a pretty heavy guitar riff, yeah, for example. But then there is something about being a teenager and having the right song on just at the right moment. That kind, yeah, of almost contrived, yes, kind of sense of knowing exactly what to play.
Right.
That's DJing a party, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that happens. Right, the bit when they make the enormous bonfire, the song... I forget what song it is, but the song starts again, which both sort of works, you know, yeah, with the affective qualities of the music as part of the film, but also clearly one of the kids is meant to have gone, yeah, let's start that song again, and actually move the needle back to the beginning. So it manages to have both, yeah, you know, deliberately.
I don't know if I'm right in saying that you never see the record being played at the party. I'm not quite sure. I can... guarantee.
No, I mean, you do see a record player, but it doesn't, I think you see a record, it doesn't seem to have any records on it, so I'm not, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, and so that would be another thing. Again, yeah, I feel perhaps another way of doing this. I sort of have in my mind a kind of an idea of a, it's a slightly unfair idea of a kind of average sort of American coming of age Asian nostalgia film.
In which music is always an important element.
But then I think you'd also have kind of fetishistic close-ups of turntables and needles, and it would be emphasised that, you know, this is what they played music on, and you know, perhaps relating to the filmmaker. You know, particularly... Yeah, the fact that vinyl has come back in recent years means that this will be different now. But a filmmaker making film in the 90s, being, oh, we don't, you know, about their childhood in the 70s, feeling, oh, we don't have records anymore. But that doesn't happen. It's just because, as far as the kids are concerned, I think that's maybe that does relate to what we were saying earlier about it being more concerned with giving a sense of how it felt, because the kids aren't excited about records as technology, because that's the technology which they have to play music. They're excited about the music.
That's it. That's right. Yeah.
As we normally say, we've decided not to bother avoiding spoilers in this podcast, right? Yeah. So watch the film first, or you know, pause your podcast now. But I mean, it's surely heavily implied that Christine kills herself at the end of the film, right?
I think it's implied. I don't know if it's heavily implied. I don't like the ending, can I just add?
Mm-hmm.
I don't like the blank note. I think it's... I found it to be a bit contrived. And I don't like the way in which he's asked to unfold the note and how long that takes... as a gesture. I find it to be I don't know, I feel like it's too much.
Yeah.
A blank note, I mean, I just feel like it's too much.
Well, yeah, that would, I understand that. I'm not sure, yeah, that would be in the context of the film sort of avoiding sort of explicit symbolism elsewhere, I suppose. This seem a heavy-handed conclusion. Yeah. Although, I mean, he takes a long time to open it because he knows it's a suicide note and he doesn't want to read what's in it.
I don't have anything to add other than it seems like an unnecessary sort of...
I mean, do you think it's sort of indicating that, there will, you know, there'll always be ambiguity, we'll never know or something? It's a kind of heavy-handed symbol.
Yeah, I guess that's where my problem is.
Mm.
If you can have such a thing as a contrived ambiguity,
I think that's maybe what it is. Yeah.
Have a think about this.
Yes. I mean, we haven't talked much about the feeling. Maybe we've been skirting around. You know, we've talked about the feelings of the film, because it does have a... It has a, as I think we've said, a kind of distance or a kind of... a kind of coolness in how it presents things, but not... I don't feel a coldness at all. I think it's quite sort of powerfully, you know, emotional, in fact.
Yeah, I think you feel that if there is any coldness, you feel it with the characters.
Mm, yeah.
Rather than watching them be subjected to it.
Yes.
And that coldness can come in many forms. There is literal coldness, the rain and the snow that ends the film.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, without wanting to sound, too simplistic about this, there's also the coldness between the parents and their children, the father and the son, and those brilliant sort of prowling, circling, tracking shots in the living room.
Yes. But it's complicated, that, between the father and the son, isn't it? Because it's not... Again, I don't quite feel that coldness is... There's a problem of distance. I mean, there's a problem of communication. But, I mean, in fact, the last shot, the last time we see the father, he has his arm around Gilles.
That's true. There's a nice switch there from those singles, extended single shots to the double shot with the two characters actually physically touching each other, which comes as quite a powerful sort of surprise.
Is it worth saying anything? Is there any more to say? Because we only sort of mentioned that it's the case about the choice to shoot it on 16mm. You know, what that contributes to the film.
Well, I suppose one thing that it gives him is mobility. Mm. So all of the things we've been talking about to do with staging and fluidity, those are largely thanks to this very lightweight camera.
Mm.
It also gives the colour a lovely gritty, textured look, which I mentioned French New Wave earlier. So this is definitively in colour and not black and white.
Yeah.
Like a lot of those early anamorphic 60s French films. And that's, I suppose, quite important. I mean, the colours are... They're slightly subdued kind of colours, aren't they? They're cold blues and...
Mm. Yeah. Yes, it's not full of... Yeah, very... Yeah.
It's not Terrence Malick.
No, it's not Terrence Malick.
Because he has the intimacy of Terrence Malick, but he doesn't have the softness.
No, but yeah, the grain itself is quite pleasing. Again, it's a sort of, you can, it's got a kind of warmth again, hasn't it? I suppose it could have a nostalgia as well, excuse the cat. He thinks it's dinner time, he's mistaken. Home videos shot at that time would maybe been shot on Super 8 or something, but there's at least the kind of positive. It doesn't look like someone's home videos, but it might have something in common with the way your home videos from that time.
That's really interesting.
Might have looked.
Sears describes the film as something that superimposes itself on his memories of being a teenager. Now he can't separate himself from it like a screen. And I wonder if he's seeing the film as a sort of a bit of a home movie. In the way that home movies aren't always, they capture certain moments and exclude other ones, don't they?
And also, in terms of how how certain scenes are constructed. There again, there are things which are, when you stop and think about them, they're actually really quite strange, but that I think they're sort of mostly they're entered into so well that you don't. You're less likely to kind of notice that fact, which maybe relates to what you say about it being almost experimental.
Mm.
You know, so there's the scene when she is actually at the, when Christine gets taken to the institution. Yeah, so she's there with her suitcase in this kind of waiting room, and there's a peculiar TV program with a fairly astonishing a cappella version of the Four Seasons. which is quite funny, as well as slightly disconcerting. The sort of one of the doctors in charge at the institution sort of is talking to her father. But they move outside, so they're talking in the grounds in the front of the building, so the camera moves forward. So we're looking out of the window, seeing these men talking to each other, presumably about Christine, who we can't see. But it's not her point of view shot at all, because she's on the other side of the room. But there's some sense of her experience is still, we're still very sort of aware of what she's experiencing, but there's also, we know what's going on, being, you know, what's being said. We know that things are being said about her, even if we don't know what they are, while the soundtrack is this, you know, bizarre Vivaldi. It's, yeah, you know, when you sort of stop and think and kind of describe it like that, it's a really quite strange, you know, combination of image and sound, are really quite complicated, but it doesn't, I don't think it feels quite like that at the time, because it gets there in a perfectly logical way.
Yeah.
It sort of, you know, it kind of gently gets you in there.
Yeah, the purpose isn't alienation at all.
No.
The film gives you enough, you could kind of almost lip read the conversation between the father and the official there at the institution. And you can maybe appreciate the contrast there between the Vivaldi and just the ridiculousness of it in this very sterile environment that means nothing at all to our main character. It means absolutely nothing to her, and
no exactly
is a place in which she does not want to be.
No, but you get all these quite rich things, but again they're not it's not a symbol of her alienation or the music, you know. There would, again, in someone else's film that was much crasser, the particular music that would be playing would have lyrics that would somehow relate. It's not that. It's just, yeah, things are dislocated, things are odd. Would the word be something like defamiliarization or something? There is at least a degree of noticing that things are made strange, but they're made strange because the life is quite strange. We might have to stop, and I might have to go and feed the cat.
It happens. Life is strange. Life intervenes.
It does.
The world goes on. Thank you for listening to Discursion. Do like and subscribe. We are on Podbean, Spotify and iTunes. And follow us on Twitter. Thanks for listening.
Yes, thank you. And we'll be back shortly with another film on another disc.
Bye.